I'd like to share a few thoughts on what we might call stubbing our toes on emptiness. Some Zen teachers, and I think many mindfulness-based stress reduction and other sort of mindfulness teachers are fond of pointing out that in the world of microphysics, in a very, very tiny particle land, seemingly solid objects are actually mainly space, and there are all these things whizzing around in them. And that's used as a metaphor for reality. And of course, it is reality on one in one dimension. But on the other hand, when we encounter a table leg, for instance, in the middle of the night when we're trying to find our way to the bathroom or something like that, that idea of emptiness of the empty table leg doesn't do much for the stubbed toe that we get from that. And I think that can remind us that even though there's an emphasis on emptiness in much of the Zen literature, form is also very important. Jeff Dawson has remarked that Zen folk tend to focus on form being empty, but not enough on emptiness being form. And various other teachers have commented on that too. So I'd like to share a few thoughts about emptiness and form, but instead of concentrating on form, on emptiness for a change, to concentrate on form and see how that may be helpful as long as we hold this balance between the two. So the basics are sort of locus classicus for this form and emptiness is in what we recite, and virtually from what I understand, every Zen and probably most Buddhist practices recite or chant at the beginning of some sort of practice, and that's it's commonly called the Heart Sutra. We've talked about this in the past, I think. To me, a better or more comprehensive translation might be something like the sutra on the heart of the wisdom of going beyond. If we look at the full title of the Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, so that heart refers to essence rather than heart mind kind of whatever. I can't point to the right bit there. It is the distillation of, it almost stands for all of Buddhism when you unpack it bit by bit, line by line. So, and this idea of the Prajnaparamita, Prajna is often translated as wisdom. The Paramita has two meanings. Sometimes it refers to specific, sometimes there's six, sometimes there are 10 different practices, sort of wisdom practices. But in the end of the Heart Sutra, as we know it, to talk about going beyond, it is going beyond and going beyond duality. And that's where the emptiness and form, it seems to me, come into it, that it actually integrates those things. So that would be a very clumsy translation, but and so there's no reason not to keep referring to it as the Heart Sutra. So I want to compare two different translations of the beginning, because as is often the case, people have made choices that go far beyond, you know, what we have in our sutra book at some point about how to translate things that have come from an Indian language through Chinese and Japanese into English. And there are differences between them, which may or may not be important in different situations. So our translation is, from the depths of Prajna wisdom, the Bodhisattva of compassion, saw into the emptiness of every construct and so passed beyond all suffering. Know then that in such depths, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. This is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and the rest of consciousness. All these, by their very nature, are emptiness, being neither born nor dying, stained nor pure, waxing nor waning. So in emptiness, there is neither form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, or consciousness, etc. no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. A slightly a more literal translation that's used by some folk is slightly different. It says, the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, while deeply immersed in Prajna Paramita, clearly perceived the empty nature of the five skandhas and transcended all suffering. Shariputra, form is not different from emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. So it is with feelings, conception, volition, and consciousness. Shariputra, all dharmas are empty in character, neither arising nor ceasing, neither impure nor pure, neither increasing nor decreasing. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, there is no feeling, conception, volition, or consciousness, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. So they're substantially the same. What has occurred to me is, in the more literal translation, it is addressed, this is addressed to Shariputra, who is a favored disciple of the Buddha, and it's talking about the Buddha or the Bodhisattva of compassion. So here the Bodhisattva of compassion is sitting deeply immersed in Prajna Paramita. So made this wisdom of going beyond duality. And the Bodhisattva then, so known in Japanese as Kanon, in Chinese as Guanyin, the Bodhisattva of compassion. The empty nature of the five skandhas. So it's quite specific. And then later on it mentions the five skandhas, which include form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. So it's actually fairly specific. And our translation doesn't talk about the five skandhas, talks about every construct. And that's a very interesting term, too. And between the two of them, you get an idea of what we're doing to ourselves, in a sense. But it may not be referring... It seems to be about other kinds of reality, such as the table leg that we're stubbing our toe on. So it's talking about, well, if we talk about this, the skandhas of form, feelings, perceptions, impulse, the rest of consciousness, these are very much related to our own being, to things that we generate, construct, to use the term in our... That seems to me to help clarify some of the boundaries here. But in the end... They both say that form is exactly the same as emptiness. Emptiness is exactly the same as form. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. We can add to that, of course, that form is form and emptiness is emptiness, to round out the sort of permutations, which would be the kind of approach that Dogen, for instance, who loves to play with words. But I noticed even Suzuki Shunryo of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in one of his talks mentions that as well. So we have all these different possibilities, which are interbeing kinds of things. They're things that are situational about what we need to emphasize at any given time. Okay, so we have Guanyin or Kanon deeply immersed in the practice of the wisdom of going beyond duality. And at that point, she or he makes this realization and transcends all suffering, because the skandhas or the constructs are empty. So it seems to me, and this very much came to me, and for those of us who were at the last session, even more than what we do today, is very much based on form. I mean, that's actually the outer structure, the scaffolding, is very rigid. You do something, we do it all together. At a certain time we do this, at a certain time we do that. There's no choice in that. And yet, within that structure, what happens? We're left completely free, just staring at the wall. And Adrian said some beautiful and provocative and somewhat humoresque drawings of what it's like, or what it was like for Adrian to sit in this freedom. And some of it's not very pretty, Adrian. and that captures it. We sit, and we all sorts of things come up, and we're completely free. In that. And then a certain time the bell rings and we get up. So Suzuki Roshi says, perfect freedom will only be acquired under some limitation. And Jeff Dawson has remarked, I was talking to him the other day, that some Tibetan teacher whom he encountered or heard of said, people who think that everything is solid and permanent are delusional, but those who think that everything is empty are even more delusional. So we've got to keep these things from becoming absolute. So my interest today is not in the emptiness of the sutra, but in the form. And it, of course, it's patently ridiculous on one level to say that we have no eyes, ear, nose, tongue, you know, body or mind, you know, or to say there's no death, suffering, or illness, that sort of thing, because we know, we encounter that in our everyday lives all the time in different forms. So as long as we don't restrict ourselves to the five skandhas and related phenomena, there's a lot to stub our toes at, or to perceive with our eyes, or with our tongue, you know, that's hot and cold and salt and sour and all that. So it seems to me that we've got to pay attention to form as well as emptiness, just as we do the Kinhin clockwise instead of anti-clockwise, or at the whim of the mediator. The direction, choosing clockwise or anti-clockwise, is probably empty. It's got no intrinsic value. Why should we go clockwise? But boy, what happens if Sally goes clockwise and I go anti-clockwise? You know, that we need that form. And we're free because I don't have to think about that. I'm not going to bump into Sally because I know we're going to be turning the same way. And just think of traffic, for instance. If we had to choose when we got on the road, which side of the road we wanted to drive on, what am I going to do? Am I going to go, you know, on the right side or the left side? And of course, the chaos that would ensue. That once we know we're driving on a certain side of the road in a certain country, for instance, because that, again, there's no intrinsic right or, no pun intended, right or wrong about which side of the road we drive on, then we're free to concentrate on where we're going and how fast we're gonna go and whether we have the lights on bright or dim. So Zen and Zen itself is full of form, as we were just remarking about the Sesshin. To go into some of Dogen's writings, so here is the most, mystical is not the right word, but playful and logic-transcending, unifying, non-dualistic thinker that I've ever encountered, and because of that, very hard for a rational mind like mine to comprehend. So he writes these incredibly transcendent kinds of teasing kinds of conceptual things. But on the other hand, he writes about very concrete things, like, and I forgot to distribute this, I mentioned to several people, we've got Dogen's instructions to the cook, for instance, and that's very detailed. But I was reading through some of the other things, and they include things like how to sleep in the dojo. You're not supposed to sleep with both. So the monks, there was a raised platform, tatami, and they spent their whole life, essentially they had a little cupboard of their own possessions that they could fit in it, and you spent the night there. So what direction your head is in, but also don't sleep with both legs straightened. One leg must be bent. He's got instructions about how to wash your face and how to dry it. And go on and on and on. So here's this, you think he's absolutely obsessive about form. And yet he's a great champion of emptiness. And it's holding that balance, it seems to me, that what becomes important. And again, perhaps inspired by what Jeff just talked a little bit about the Zen precepts in the session too. And that strikes me as a very form-laden thing. Or a series of conventions that Zen or Buddhists may embrace. And to take two examples from the San Francisco Zen site, a disciple of the Buddha does not misuse sexuality, but rather cultivates and encourages honest and caring relationships, is one of the precepts. Given what we're seeing all around the at least Western, well, it's not only the Western world too, but Me Too movement and related phenomena, the trouble we get into by not understanding this kind of precept, misusing sexuality is very dangerous. And it seems to me if there is a precept or there is a guideline about that, and these are not, of course, as phrased in thou shalt not kind of commandments, but that's what's one of the beauties about some of the modern phrasing, that there's a positive and a sort of prohibitory side of it. But if I'm not, if there's certain boundaries on our relationship, I'm not, it frees me to cultivate that relationship in a very free way without worrying about the sexual side of it. The San Francisco Zen Center actually has that's the one they're most detailed about. They say when new people come that there shouldn't be any sort of sexual relationship between them and older people, people who've been there for longer, for at least 6 months. That doesn't prohibit in the long run, but the dangers of exploiting a more naive person who's come into the Zendo are great, and it just, and of course that can trigger then all sorts of karmic cause and effect problems down the line, both for the perpetrator and the target, and then people related to them, and there's no need to talk more about that. But so to have that precept, I think, frees up relations, either heterosexual or homosexual relations, in a way that if you're wondering about sex all the time, may not be possible. And a second one out of the, I can't remember if they're 8, 10, there changes too with different groups. Disciple of the Buddha does not slander others, but rather cultivates and encourages respectful speech. That's often translated and as gossip, that sort of. And it made me think the other day, I serve on a committee for our council, and there's one person on the committee who's so completely out of line with everybody, and she's so in your face on top of it. And I was talking to another committee member, and I don't think I was slandering her or anything, but I was observing the same things. Oh, she's her own worst enemy. But in fact, there was no need for me. That was a topic of conversation that I just raised. It had nothing to do with the rest of the conversation that I was having. Why bother for that matter? Why focus on that one person? Especially if it wasn't particularly negative, it was an observation, I think. But sometimes you have to. Sometimes the problems to solve. Sometimes there's compulsory reporting of things that you have to talk about. But in general, that gratuitous talking about other people can be very unhelpful, and it can escalate, of course, to gossip and talking about people behind their back. So it seems to me, in the end, that this sutra really focuses on the bodhisattva's project of bringing together two essential characteristics of Zen practice: the wisdom, the prajna, and the compassion, the kanon or guanyin figure. So can we shed our own propensity to binary, dualistic thinking, either-or thinking, and embrace both form and emptiness?